holding up for him to admire. A photocopy in those days is a big matter. Plate photographs, tied into a loose-leaf book, with bootlaces through the holes. Axel presses it upon Pym, and again rouses him sufficiently from the material in the folder to make him study the portrait of the bearer, a piggy, part-shaven little man with puffy eyes and a pout.
"That is me, Sir Magnus," Axel says, and bangs Pym on the shoulder quite hard to assure his attention,
exactly as he used to in Bern. "Look at him, will you? He's a greedy, grubby fellow. Farts a lot, scratches his head, steals his commandant's chickens. But he doesn't like his country to be occupied by a bunch of sweating Ivans who swagger around the streets of Prague and tell him he's a stinking little Czech. And he doesn't like being packed down to Austria at somebody's whim to play toady to a lot of drunk Cossacks. So he's brave, too, you follow me? He's a brave little greasy coward."
Pym again pauses in his reading, this time to register a bureaucratic complaint, which later causes him some shame.
"It's all very well inventing this delightful character, Axel, but what am I to do with him?" he reasons in an aggrieved tone. "I'm supposed to produce a defector, not a paybook. They want a warm body back there in Graz. I haven't got one, have I?"
"You idiot!"
cries Axel, pretending to be exasperated by Pym's obtuseness.
"You guileless English baby! Have you never heard of a defector in place? Pavel is a defector. He's defecting, but staying where he is. In 3 weeks' time he'll come here again, bring you more material. He'll defect not just once, but if you are sensible, 20 times, 100. He's an intelligence clerk, a courier, a low-grade field man, a bottle washer, a coding sergeant, and a pimp. Don't you understand what that means in terms of access? He will bring you wonderful intelligence again and again. His friends in the frontier unit will help him cross. Next time we meet, you will have Vienna's questions for him. You will be at the center of a fantastic industry. Can you get us this, Pavel? What does this mean, Pavel? If you're polite to him, if you come alone, bring him a nice present, maybe he'll answer them.
And will it be you? Will I see you?
You will see Pavel.
And will you be Pavel?
Sir Magnus, listen.
Pushing aside the briefcase that lay between them, Axel bangs his glass beside Pym's, and yanks his chair so close that his shoulder is nudging against Pym's shoulder, and his mouth is at Pym's ear.
Are you being very, very attentive now?
Of course I am.
Because I think you are so fantastically stupid, you better not play this game at all. Listen.
Pym is grinning exactly as he used to grin when Axel was explaining why he was a trottle for not understanding Kant.
What Axel is doing for you tonight, he can never undo in his whole life. I am risking my bloody neck for you. Like Sabina gave you her brother, Axel gives you Axel. Do you understand? Or are you too shit stupid to recognize that I am putting my future in your hands?
I don't want it, Axel. I'd rather give it back.
It's too late. I've stolen the papers. I have come over. You have seen them. You know what they contain. Pandora's box cannot be closed again. Your nice Major Membury, those clever aristos in Div Int, none of them ever saw such information. Do you follow this?
Pym nods, Pym shakes his head, Pym frowns, smiles, and tries to look in every way he can the worthy and mature custodian of Axel's destiny.
In return, you must swear me one thing. I told you earlier, you must not promise. Now I tell you, you must. To me, Axel, you must promise loyalty.
Sergeant Pavel is a different matter. Sergeant Pavel, you can betray and invent as much as you like. He is an invention anyway. But I, Axel, this Axel here, look at me. I do not exist. Not for Membry, not for Sabina, not even for yourself. Even when you are lonely and bored, and you need to impress somebody or buy somebody or sell somebody, I am not a creature in your game. If your own people threaten you, if they torture you, you must still deny me.
If they put you on the cross in 50 years from now, will you lie for me? Answer.
Pym finds time to marvel that after energetically denying Axel's existence for so long, he should be promising him to deny it for still longer. And that it must be a very rare thing indeed to be offered a second chance to prove one's loyalty after failing so miserably at the first attempt.
I will, says Pym.
What will you?
I will keep your secret. I'll lock you in my memory and give you the key. For always.
Sabina's brother Jan also.
For always.
Jan too.
That's the whole Soviet order of battle in Czechoslovakia you've given me, says Pym in a trance.
If it's genuine.
It's a little bit old, but you British know how to value antiquity. Your maps in Vienna and Graz are older, and they are not so genuine. You like memory?
I think so. Why?
Me too. You are interested in fish? You are helping him to restock the lake?
Sometimes, yes.
That's important work. Do it with him. Help him.
It's a lousy world, Sir Magnus. A few happy fish will make it better.
It was 6 in the morning when Pym left. Kaufman had long ago put himself to bed in the jeep. Pym could see his boots sticking over the tailboard. Pym and Axel walked as far as the White Stone, Axel leaning on his arm, the way he used to when they walked beside their Are. As they reached it, Axel stooped and picked a harvest poppy and handed it to Pym. Then he picked another for himself, which on reflection he handed to Pym also.
There is one of me and one of you, Sir Magnus. There will never be another of either of us. You are the keeper of our friendship. Give my love to Sabina. Tell her that Sergeant Pavel sends her a special kiss to thank her for her help.
A man with a highly regarded source is an admired man and a well-fed one, Tom, as Pym quickly discovered in the next few weeks. Visiting very senior officers from Vienna take him to dinner just for the touch of him and the vicarious feel of his achievement. Membury comes too, a grinning, loping Caesar dwarfing his Antony, hauling on his ear, dreaming of fish, and smiling at the wrong people. Other officers, less senior but still substantial, alter their opinion of Pym overnight, and send him smarmy notes by interzonal bag. Marlena sends her love and is so sad that you had to leave Vienna without saying goodbye to her. It looked for a moment as if I might become your CO, but fate decreed otherwise. Em and I hope to be engaged as soon as we get clearance from the War Office. He is a cult of one, and to know him is to be an insider. The fantastic work young Pym is doing. If I had my way, I'd give him a third pip, national serviceman or not. You should have heard London on the Scrambler. They're sending it to the top. On London's orders, no less, Sergeant Pavel receives the codename Greensleeves, and Pym a commendation. Voluptuous Czech interpreters are proud of him, and demonstrate their pleasure in refined ways.
You must never tell me what happened. It is a rule, Sabina ordered him,
biting him half to death between her deep, sad lips.
I never will.
He is handsome, Jan's friend. He is beautiful, like you. I would love him immediately, yes.
He is tall and beautiful and very intelligent.
Sexy also?
Very sexy.
Homosexual? Like you?
Totally.
The description pleased her in some deep and satisfying way.
You are a good man, Magnus, she assured him. You have good taste that you protect this man like my brother.
The due day came round when Sergeant Pavel was to make his second appearance. As Axel had predicted, Vienna had prepared a dense crop of follow-up questions for him concerning his first offering. Pym arrived with them, written out in a shorthand notebook. He also brought brown smoked salmon sandwiches and an excellent Sancerre from Membury. He brought cigarettes and coffee and naffy mint chocolates and everything else the gastronomic experts of Divint could think of to fill the tummy of a brave defector in place. While they ate the smoked salmon and drank vodka, they cleared up the outstanding points.
So what have you got for me this time round? Pym inquired, cheerfully, when they had reached a natural break in the proceedings.
Nothing, Axel replied, comfortably, helping himself to more vodka. We let them starve a little. Gives them a better appetite next time.
Pavel's having a crisis of conscience, Pim reported next day to memory, obeying Axel's instructions to the letter. He's having wife trouble, and his daughter is going to bed with a no-good Russian officer every time Pavel is sent down to Austria. I didn't press him. I told him we were there, and he could trust us, and we're not adding to his pressures. I believe in the long run he's going to thank us for that, but I did ask him our questions about the concentrated armor east of Prague, and he was interesting.
A visiting colonel from Vienna was sitting in.
What did he say? Asked the colonel, following Pim closely.
He said he thinks it's guarding something.
Any idea what?
Weaponry of some sort. Could be rockets.
Stay with him, the colonel advised, and Membry puffed out his cheeks and looked like the proud father he had become.
At their third meeting, Source Greensleeve solved the mystery of the concentrated armor and produced in addition a breakdown of the total Soviet air strength in Czechoslovakia as of November last, or nearly total. Vienna was in any case amazed, and London authorized the payment of two small gold bars, on condition that the British assay marks first be removed for reasons of deniability. Sergeant Pavel was thus characterized as a greedy man, which made everybody feel easier. For several months after this, Pim scampered back and forth between Axel and Membry, like a butler serving two masters. Membry wondered whether he should meet Greensleeves in person. Vienna seemed to think it would be a good idea. Pim tried for him, but came back with the sad news that he would treat only with Pim. Membry resigned himself. It was the breeding season for trout. Vienna summoned Pim and dined him. Colonels, air commodores and naval persons vied to stake their claim to him. But it was Axel, as it turned out, who was his true proprietor and parent company.
Sir Magnus, Axel whispered. Something very terrible has happened.
His smile had lost its bounce. His eyes were haunted, and there were heavy shadows under them. Pim had brought any number of natty delicacies, but he refused them all.
You have to help me, Sir Magnus, he said,
darting scared looks towards the barn door.
You're my only hope. Help me, for Christ's sake. Do you know what they do to people like me? Don't look at me like that. Think of something for a change. It's your turn.
I am in the barn at this moment, Tom. I've lived there these 30 and more years. Miss Dubber's stippled ceiling has rolled away, leaving the old rafters and the upside-down bats dangling from the roof. I can smell his cigar smoke as I sit here, and I can see the holes of his dark eyes in the lamplight as he whispers Pim's name like the invalid he used to be.
Get me music, get me painting, get me bread, get me secrets.
But there is no self-pity in his voice, no supplication or regret. That was never Axel's way. He demands. His voice is sometimes soft, it is true, but it is never less than powerful. He is his man as ever. He is Axel. He is Ode. He has crossed frontiers and been beaten. Of myself, I am thinking nothing at all. Not now, not then.
They are arresting my friends back home, do you hear?
Two of our group were dragged from their beds yesterday morning in Prague. Another vanished on his way to work. I had to tell them about us. It was the only way.
The import of this statement takes a moment to penetrate Pim's worried understanding. Even when it has done so, his voice remains mystified.
About us? Me?
What did you say? Who to, Axel? Not in detail, in principle.
Nothing bad, not your name. It's okay, just more complicated. Takes more handling. I've been more cunning than the others. In the end, it may be better.
But what did you tell them about us?
Nothing. Listen. For me, it's different. The others, they work in factories, in the universities. They've no back door. When they're tortured, they tell the truth, and the truth kills them. But me?
I'm a big spy. I've got a strong position, same as you.
Sure, I say to them, I go over the border. That's my job. I collect intelligence, remember? I act indignant. I demand to see my senior officer. He's not bad, this senior officer. Not 100%, maybe 60. But he hates the Ivans, too. I'm cultivating a British traitor, I tell him. He's a big fish, an army officer. I have kept it secret from you because of the many Titoists inside our organization. Get the secret police off my back and you can share his product with me when I put the heat on him.
Pym has given up speech by now. He doesn't bother to ask what the senior officer says in reply, or to what extent the real life of Axel may be compared with the fictitious life of Sergeant Pavel. The cells are dying all over him, in his head, his groin, his bone marrow. His loving thoughts about Sabina are as old as childhood memories to him. There is only Pym and Axel and disaster in the world. He is changing into an old man even while he listens. The ignorance of age is descending on him.
He says I've got to bring him proof, says Axel a second time.
Proof? Pym mumbles.
What sort of proof? Proof? I don't follow you.
Intelligence. Axel rubs his finger against his thumb, exactly as E. Weber once did.
Pinka pinka. Product. Money. Something a British traitor like you could give me when I blackmailed him. It doesn't have to be the secrets of the atom bomb, but it has to be good. Good enough to keep him quiet. No junk, you understand. He's got senior officers, too.
Axel smiles, though it is not a smile I care to recollect even now.
There's always one guy higher up the ladder, isn't there, Sir Magnus? Even when you think you're at the top. Then when you reach the top, there they are again below you, swinging on your boots. That's how it is in a system like ours. No fabrication, he says to me. Whatever it is, it's got to have quality. Then we can fix it.
Steal for me, Sir Magnus. As you love my freedom. Get me something wonderful.
You look as though you've been seeing things, Corporal Kaufman says, as Pym returns to the jeep.
It's my stomach, says Pym. But on the journey back to Graz, he began to feel better. Life is duty, he reflected. It's just a question of establishing which creditor is asking loudest. Life is paying. Life is seeing people right if it kills you.
There were half a dozen reconstructed Pims wandering the streets of Graz that night, Tom. And there isn't one of them I need now feel ashamed of, or wouldn't happily embrace as a long-lost son who had paid his debt to society and come home, if he knocked on Miss Dubber's door at this moment and said, "Father, it's me." I don't think there was a night in his life when he thought less about himself and more about his obligation to others than when he was patrolling his city kingdom under the shadows of crumbling Habsburg glories, pausing now at the leafy gates of Membry's spacious married quarters, now at the doorway to Sabina's unprepossessing apartment house, while he made his plan and flashed them reassuring promises. "Don't worry about a thing," he told Membry in his heart. "You will suffer no humiliation. Your lake will continue to be stocked, and your post will be safe for as long as you care to adorn it. The highest in the land will continue to respect you as the presiding genius of the Greensleeves operation." "Your secrets are in my hands," he whispered to Sabina's unlit window. "Your employment by the British, your heroic brother Jan, your exalted opinion of your lover Pym are all secure. I shall cherish them as I cherish your soft, warm body, sleeping its troubled sleep." He took no decisions, because he had no doubts. The lone crusader had identified his mission. The skilled spy would take care of the detail. The loyal attacher would never again betray his friend in exchange for the illusion of being a servant of national necessity. His loves, his duties and allegiances had never been clearer. "Axel, I owe you. Together we can change the world. I will bring you gifts, as you brought gifts to me. I will never again send you to the camps." If he contemplated alternatives, then it was only to reject them as disastrous. Over the last months, the inventive Pym had built Sergeant Pavel into a figure of joy and admiration in the secret corridors of Graz, Vienna, and Whitehall. Under his skillful hand, the choleric little hero's drinking, womanizing, and quixotic bursts of courage had become a legend.
Even if Pym were prepared to break Axel's trust a second time, how could he go to Membury and say, "Sir, Sergeant Parvel does not exist. Greensleeves is my friend Axel, who requires that we give him genuine British secrets." Membury's kindly eyes would pop open. His innocent face would collapse in lines of sadness and despair. His trust in Pym would wither, his reputation with it. Membury to the lantern, sack Membury. Membury, his wife and all his daughters, go home. And even worse disaster would result if Pym were to strike a compromise by visiting Axel's dilemma upon the fictitious Sergeant Parvel. He had played that scene too in his imagination. "Sir, Sergeant Parvel's frontier crossings have been noticed. He has told the Czech secret police that he has a British agent in play. We must therefore give him chicken feed to back his story." Div Int had no mandate to run double agents, Gratz even less so. Even a defector in place was stretching things. Only Greensleeve's insistence on being handled by Pym personally had prevented a takeover by London long ago. And there was already a lot of earnest talk going on about who would get Parvel when Pym's military service expired. To place Axel or Sergeant Parvel in the position of a double agent would unloose a string of immediate consequences, all frightful. Membury would lose Greensleeves to London. Pym's successor would discover the deception in 5 minutes. Axel would once more be betrayed, and his chances of survival forfeit. The Membury's would be posted to Siberia. No, Tom. As Pym walked the momentous night away under a canopy of unreachable ideals, eschewing Sabina's bed in his purity of soul, he was not tormenting himself over great choices. He was not examining his immortal spirit in anticipation of what purists might call a treasonable act. He did not consider that tomorrow was the day set for his irrevocable execution, the day on which all hope for Pym would die and your father would be born. He was watching the dawn rise on a day of beauty and harmony, a day when a bad record could be put straight, when the fate of everyone he was responsible for rested in his care, when the electors of his secret constituency would go down on their knees and thank Pym and his Maker that he had been born to see them right. He was glowing and exulting. He was letting his goodwill and self-faith fill him up with courage. The secret crusader had placed his sword upon the altar and was transmitting fraternal messages to the God of Battles. "Axel, come over," Pym had begged him. "Forget about Sergeant Parvel. You can be an ordinary defector. I'll look after you. I'll get you everything you need, I promise." But Axel was as fearless as he was determined. "Do not advise me to betray my friends, Sir Magnus. I am the only one who can save them. Did I not tell you I have crossed my last frontier? If you help me, we can win a great victory. Be here on Wednesday at the same time." Briefcase in hand, Pym makes quickly for the top floor of the villa and unlocks the door to his office. "I am a morning man, it is known of me. Pym is an early riser. Pym is keen. Pym has done a day's work while most of us are still shaving." Membury's office is linked to his own by a pair of grand doors. Pushing them open, Pym steps inside. As he does so, his sense of well-being becomes unbearable, a dizzying blend of resolution, rightness, and release. "I am blessed." Membury's tin desk is no Reichskanzlei desk. It has an old tin back, and Pym's Swiss Army penknife knows the four screws well. In the third drawer down, on the left side, Membury keeps his basic works of reference. Standing orders for the unit. Brown fish of the world. Classified telephone directory. Lakes and waterways of Austria. Order of Battle of Military Intelligence in London. A list of leading aquaria, and a chart for Div Int, Vienna, showing units and their functions, but no names. Pym reaches a hand in. Not an invasion. Not a retribution. No initials are being carved into the panelling. I am here to administer a caress. Folders, loose-leaf manuals. Signals instructions marked Top Secret, Guard, which Pym has never seen. I am here to borrow, not to steal. Opening his briefcase, he extracts an Army-issue Agfa camera with a 1-foot measuring chain fastened to the lens front. It is the same camera that he uses when Axel brings out raw material, and Pim has to photograph it on the spot. He cocks it and sets it on the desk. "This is what I was born for," he thinks, not for the first time. "In the beginning was the spy." From a file with the word vertebrates crossed out on the cover, he selects the order of battle of Div Int. Axel knows it anyway, he reasons. Nevertheless, there are impressive top secret stamps at top and bottom, and a distribution stamp to guarantee authenticity. "As you love my freedom, get me something wonderful." He photographs it once, then again, and is left with a feeling of anticlimax. "There are 36 frames on this film. Why do I cheese pear and give him only 2? I could do something for our mutual understanding. Axel, you deserve better." He remembers a recent War Office assessment of the Soviet threat. If they read that, they'll read anything. It is in the top drawer, beside a handbook of water mammals, and begins with a summary of conclusions. He photographs each page and finishes the film nicely. "Axel, I've done it. We're free. We've put the world to rights, exactly as you said we would. We are men of the middle ground. We have founded our own country with a population of 2. "Promise you will never bring me anything so good again, Sir Magnus," said Axel at their next meeting. "If you do, they will make me a general, and we shall not be able to meet any more." "Dear father," Pim wrote to the majestic Hotel Karachi, where Rick appeared to be living for his health, "thanks for your 2 letters. I'm so glad to hear you are hitting it off with the Aga Khan. I believe I am doing good work out here, and you would be proud of me." Chapter 14. When Mary Pym, at the age of 16, decided it was time to lose her virginity, she faked a heavy dose of adolescent vapours and had herself put to bed by Motrin, instead of playing hockey. There she lay in the sick wing, staring at the wall, till the 3 o'clock bell rang, telling her that Motrin was off duty until 5. She waited 5 more minutes exactly by her confirmation watch, held her breath for 30 seconds, which always helped to get her courage up, then tiptoed down the stone back stairs, past the kitchens and the laundry, and across a bit of sour grass, to an old brick potting shed, where the undergardener had made a provisional bed of blankets and old sacking. The results were more spectacular than she had reason to hope, but what she relished afterwards was not the event so much as the anticipation of it. The lying boldly on the bed, with her skirt wrapped round her waist, knowing nothing was going to stop her now she had made up her mind. The sense of freedom, as she took herself across the border into a state of sin. And that was the feeling she had now, sitting demurely in the centre row in Caroline Lumsden's over-furnished drawing room, with her hideous Thai tables and her garish Chinese paintings and her shelf full of factory-made Buddhas, listening to Caroline trying to sound like the Queen as she moaned out the minutes of the last meeting of the Vienna branch of the Diplomatic Wives Association in her plummy swan song. "I'll do it," Mary told herself, dead calm. "If it doesn't work one way, I'll make it work another." She glanced to the window. In their hired Mercedes across the street, Georgie and Fergus were sitting with their heads together, 2 lovers pretending to study a street map, while they kept an eye on the front door and her Rover parked in Caroline's drive. "I'll take the back way out. It worked then, it'll work now."
"It was therefore unanimously agreed," Caroline was lamenting, "that the Foreign Office Inspector's report on the local cost of living was both distorted and unfair, and that a finance subcommittee would be formed immediately, headed, I am pleased to say, by Mrs. McCormack."
Respectful hush. Ruth McCormack was the wife of the economic minister, and therefore a financial genius. Nobody mentioned that she was screwing the Dutch military attaché.
"The subcommittee will itemize all our points, and having done so, submit a written objection to our association in London for submission through the proper channels to the head of the inspectorate himself."
Patter of soprano applause from 14 pairs of female hands, Mary's included. Great, Caroline, great. In another life, it would be your turn to be the rising young diplomat, and your husband's to stay home and imitate you. Caroline had turned to any other business. Next Monday, our weekly transatlantic lunch at Mance's. 12:30 sharp and 400 shillings a head. Cash, please, to include 2 glasses of wine, and please don't be late, as Herr Mance took an awful lot of persuading to give us a private room.
Pause. Say it, you fool, Mary urged her.
Caroline didn't. Not yet.
Then on Friday, 1 week today, please, Marjorie de Weaver will be giving her really fascinating lantern lecture here on aerobics, which she taught very successfully to an all-ranks class in the Sudan, where her husband was second man. Right, Marjorie?
Well, chargé, really, Marjorie roared from the front row. The ambassador was only there for 3 months out of 14. Not that Brian got paid for it, but that's beside the point.
For pity's sake, thought Mary furiously. Now! But she had forgotten about Penny Sharlow's bloody husband landing a medal.
And I'm sure we'd all like to congratulate Penny on the fantastic support she's given to James over the years, without which I bet he wouldn't have got anything at all.
This was apparently a joke, because there was hysterical laughter by too few voices, which Caroline quelled with a mournful stare into the middle distance. She put on her official mourning voice.
And Mary, darling, you did say you wouldn't mind if I mentioned it.
Mary looked hastily downward to her lap.
I'm sure everyone would like me to say how sorry we are about the death of your father-in-law. We know Magnus has been hit very hard, and we do hope he will get over it soon and be back among us in his usual high spirits that we all find so refreshing.
Sympathetic murmurs. Mary whispered thank you and keeled forward, not too far. She sensed the anxious pause while everyone waited for her head to come up, but it didn't. She began to shake and was impressed to see real tears flopping onto her clenched hands. She let out a little choke, and from her willed darkness heard cheerful Mrs. Simpson, wife of the Chancery Guard, say, "Come here, lovey," as she put an enormous arm round Mary's back. She choked again, pushed Mrs. Simpson half-heartedly away, and struggled to her feet, tears everywhere. Tears for Tom, tears for Magnus, tears for being deflowered in the potting shed and I bet I'm pregnant. She let Mrs. Simpson take her arm. She shook her head and stammered, I'm fine. She reached the hall to find that Caroline Lumsden had followed her out.
No, thanks, but really, I don't want to lie down. Far rather just take a walk. Get my coat, please. Blue, with a foul fur collar. I'd rather be alone, if you don't mind. You've been so kind. Oh, Christ, I'm going to cry again.
Once in the Lumsden's long back garden, she wandered, still hunched along the path until it dropped out of sight behind the trees. Then she moved fast. Training, she thought gratefully, as she unlatched the back gate. Nothing quite like it for cooling the blood. She headed quickly for the bus stop. There was one every 14 minutes. She had looked them up.
How terribly good of them, cried
Mrs. Membury, with the greatest satisfaction, as she topped up Brotherhood's glass with her homemade elderflower wine.
And I do think that's far-sighted and sensible. I'd never have supposed the War Office would have half the wit. Would you, Harrison?
Not deaf,
she explained to Brotherhood while they waited.
Just slow thinking. Would you, darling?
Harrison Membury had come up from the stream at the end of the garden, where he had been cutting reeds, and he was still wearing his waders. He was large and loping, and at 70, still boyish, with pink immature cheeks and silk-white hair. He sat at the far end of the table, washing down homemade cake, with tea from a huge pottery mug, with Gramps written on it. He moved, Brotherhood reckoned, at exactly half his wife's pace, and spoke at half the volume.
"Oh, I don't know,"
he said, when everyone else had forgotten the question.
"There were some quite clever chaps scattered around the place, here and there. Ask him about fish, and you'll get a far quicker answer.
said Mrs. Membury, hurtling off to the corner of the room and pulling out some albums from among the collected works that Evelyn wore.
"How are the trout, Harrison?"
"Oh, they're all right," said Membury, with a grin.
"We're not allowed to eat them, you know. Only the pike can do that. Now, would it be fun to look at my photographs? I mean, is it going to be an illustrated history? Don't tell me. It doubles the cost. It said so in the Observer. Pictures double the cost of a book. But then I do think they double the attractiveness, too. Especially with biographies. I can't be doing with biography if I can't look at the people who are being biogged. Harrison can. He's cerebral. I'm visual. Which are you?"
"I think I must be more your way," said Brotherhood, with a smile, playing his ponderous role. The village was one of those half-urbanized Georgian settlements on the edge of Bath, where English Catholics of a certain standing have elected to gather in their exile. The cottage lay at the country end of it, a tiny sandstone mansion with a steep, narrow garden descending to a stretch of river, and they sat in the cluttered kitchen on wheel-back chairs, surrounded by washing-up and vaguely votive bric-a-brac. A cracked ceramic plaque of the Virgin Mary from Lourdes, a disintegrating rush cross jammed behind the cooker, a child's paper mobile of angels rotating in the draught, a photograph of Ronald Knox. While they talked, filthy grandchildren wandered in and stared at them before tall mothers swept them off. It was a household in permanent and benevolent disorder, pervaded by the gentle thrill of religious persecution. A white morning sun was poking through the bath mist. There was a sound of slow water dripping in the gutters.
"You an academic chap?"
Membry inquired suddenly from the end of the table.
"Darling, I told you. He's an historian."
"Well, more a retired trooper, I suppose, sir, to be honest," Brotherhood replied. "I was lucky to get the job. I'd have been on the shelf by now if this hadn't come along."
"Now, when will it come out?"
Mrs. Membury shouted, as if everyone were deaf.
"I've got to know months in advance, so I can put my name down with Mrs. Lanyon. Tristram, don't tug. We have a mobile library here, you know. Magda, darling, do something about Tristram. He's trying to tear a page out of history. They come once a week, and they're an absolute godsend as long as you don't mind waiting. Now, this is Harrison's villa, where he had his office, and everyone worked for him. The main bit's 1680. The wing's new. Well, 19th. This is his pond. He stocked it from scratch. The Gestapo had thrown grenades into it and blown up all the fish. They would, pigs."
"From what my masters say, it will start out as a work of internal reference," Brotherhood said. "Then afterwards they'll publish a sanitized version for the open market."
"You're not M.R.D. Foote, are you?"
said Mrs. Membury.
No, you can't be. You're Marlowe. Well, I think they're inspired anyway. So sensible to get hold of the actual people before they peg out."
"Who did you troop with?" Membury said. "Let's just say I did a little of this and a little of that," Brotherhood suggested, with deliberate coyness, while he pulled on his reading glasses.
"There he is,"
said Mrs. Membury, stabbing a tiny finger at a group photograph.
"There. That's the young man you were asking about. Magnus. He did all the really brilliant work. That's the old Rittmeister. He was an absolute darling. Harrison, what was the mess waiter's name? The one who ought to have become a novice, but didn't have the gump."
"Forget," said Membury. "And who are the girls?" said Brotherhood, smiling.
"Oh, my dear, they were all sorts of trouble. Each one dottier than the next. And if they weren't pregnant, they were running off with unsuitable lovers, cutting their wrists. I could have opened a Mary Stopes clinic for them full time if we'd believed in birth control in those days. Now we're hybrids. Our girls are on the pill. But they still get pregnant by mistake."
"They did the interpreting for us," Membury said, filling himself a pipe. "Was there an interpreter involved in the Greensleeves operation?" Brotherhood said.
"No need," said Membury. "Chap spoke German. Pym handled him alone.
Completely alone. Solo. Greensleeves insisted on it.
Why don't you talk to Pym?
But who took him over when Pym left?
I did, said Membury proudly, brushing wet tobacco from the front of his disgraceful pullover.
There is nothing like a red-backed notebook to instill order into desultory conversation. Having spread one very deliberately among the debris of several meals, and shaken out his big right arm as a prelude to becoming what he called a little bit official, Brotherhood drew a pen from his pocket, with as much ceremony as a village policeman at the scene of the occurrence. The grandchildren had been removed. From an upper room came the sounds of someone trying to coax religious music from a xylophone.
If we could get it all down first, I can come back to the individual specifics later, said Brotherhood.
Jolly good idea, said Mrs. Membury, sternly. Harrison, darling, listen.
Unfortunately, as I have already told you, most of the raw material on Greensleeves has been destroyed, lost, or misplaced, which puts even greater responsibility on the shoulders of surviving witnesses. That's you. Now then.
For a while after this forbidding warning, there was relative sanity, while Membury, with surprising accuracy, recalled the dates and content of Greensleeve's principal triumphs, and the part played by Lieutenant Magnus Pym of the Intelligence Corps. Brotherhood wrote diligently and prompted little, only pausing to wet his thumb and turn the pages of his notebook.
Harrison, darling, you're being slow again, Mrs. Membury interposed occasionally. Marlowe hasn't got all day.
And once,
Marlowe's got to get back to London, darling. He's not a fish.
But Membury continued swimming at his own good pace, now describing Soviet military emplacements in southern Czechoslovakia, now the laborious procedure for prizing small gold bars out of the Whitehall war chests, which Greensleeves insisted on receiving in payment, now the fights he had had with Div Int to protect his pet agent from being overused. And Brotherhood, despite the little tape recorder that nestled once more in his wallet pocket, set it all out for them to see. Dates left, material centre.
Greensleeves didn't have any other code name at any time, did he? He asked casually as he jotted. Sometimes a source gets rechristened for security reasons or because the name's already been bagged.
Think, Harrison, Mrs. Membury urged.
Membury took his pipe from his mouth.
Source Wentworth, Brotherhood suggested, turning a page.
Membury shook his head.
There was also a source...
Brotherhood faltered slightly, as if the name had nearly escaped him.
Serena, that was it.
No, it wasn't.
Sabina.
Source Sabina. Operating out of Vienna. Or was it Graz?
Maybe it was Graz before your time.
Used to be a popular thing, that, anyway. Mixing up the sexes with the cover names. A quite general trick of disinformation, I'm told.
Sabina! Cried Mrs. Membury. Not our Sabina!
He's talking about a source, darling, Membury said firmly, coming in much more quickly than was his habit. Our Sabina was an interpreter, not an agent. Quite different.
Well, our Sabina was an absolute...
She wasn't a source, said Membury firmly. Now come on, don't tittle-tattle.
Poppy.
I beg your pardon, said Brotherhood. Magnus wanted to call him Poppy. We did for a bit. Source Poppy. I rather liked it. Then up came Remembrance Day, and some ass in London decided Poppy was derogatory to the fallen. Poppies are for heroes, not traitors. Absolutely typical of those chaps. Probably got promoted for it. Total buffoon. I was furious. So was Magnus. Poppy is a hero, he said. I liked him for that. Nice chap.
That's the bare bones done, then, said Brotherhood, surveying his handiwork. Now let's flesh them out, can we?
He was reading from the subject headings he had written at the beginning of his notebook before he came.
Personalities. Well, we're touching on that. Value or otherwise of national servicemen to the peacetime intelligence effort. Were they a help or a hindrance? We'll come to that. Where they all went afterwards.
did they attain positions of interest in their chosen walk of life. Well, you may have kept up with them, and there again you may not. That's more for us to worry about than you.
Yes, well, now, whatever did happen to Magnus? Mrs. Membury demanded. Harrison was so upset he never wrote. Well, so was I. He never even told us whether he converted. He was awfully close, we felt. All he needed was one more shove. Harrison was exactly like that for years. It took a jolly good talking to from Father Darcy before Harrison saw the light, didn't it, darling?
Membury's pipe had gone out, and he was peering disappointedly into the bowl. I never liked the chap, he explained, with a kind of embarrassed regret. Never thought much to him.
Darling, don't be silly. You adored Magnus. You practically adopted him. You know you did.
Oh, Magnus was a splendid chap. The other chap, the sauce, the green-sleeves chap. I thought he was a bit of a fraud, to be honest. I didn't say anything. Didn't seem useful. With Div Int and London waving their caps in the air, why should we complain?
Nonsense, said Mrs. Membury, very firmly indeed. Marlowe, don't listen. Darling, you're being far too modest as usual. You were the linchpin of the operation. You know you were. Marlowe's writing a history, darling. He's going to write about you. You mustn't spoil it for him, must he, Marlowe? That's the fashion these days. Put down, put down. I get absolutely sick of it. Look at what they did to poor Captain Scott on the television. Daddy knew Scott. He was a marvellous man.
Membury continued, as if she hadn't spoken. All the brigadiers from Vienna beaming away like sandboys. Roars of applause from the Foreign Office. No point in me killing the golden goose if they were all happy, was there? Young Magnus Cock-a-Hoop? Well, I didn't want to spoil his fun.
And he was taking instruction, said Mrs. Membury, pointedly. Harrison had arranged for him to go to Father Moynihan twice a week. And he was running garrison cricket. And he was learning Czech. You can't do that in a day.
Ah, now, that's interesting, about the learning Czech, I mean. Was this because he had a Czech source, then?
It's because Sabina's had her cap at him, the little minx, said Mrs. Membury.
But this time her husband actually spoke through her. His stuff was all so flashy somehow, he was saying, undeterred. Always looked good on the plate, but when you came to chew it over, nothing really there. That's how it seemed to me. He gave a puzzled giggle.
Same as trying to eat a pike. All bones. You'd get a report in, look it over. I say that's jolly good, you'd think. But when you took a closer look, it was boring. Yes, that's true because we already know it. Yes, that's possible, but we can't verify it because we've nothing on that region.
I didn't like to say anything, but I think the Czechs could have been batting and bowling at the same time. I always thought that was why Greensleeves didn't show up after Magnus went back to England. He wasn't so sure he could hoodwink an older chap. Mean of me, I expect.
I'm just a failed fish freak, aren't I, Hannah? That's what she calls me. Failed fish freak.
The description pleased them both so much that they broke out laughing for some while, so that Brotherhood had to laugh with them and keep back his question until Membury was able to hear him clearly.
You mean you never met Greensleeves? He never came to the rendezvous?
I'm sorry, sir, he said, returning to his notebook.
But didn't you say just now you yourself took over Source Greensleeves when Pym left Graz?
I did.
And now you say you never met him.
Perfectly true, I didn't.
Stood me up at the altar, didn't he, Hannah?
She got me into my best suit, packed together all these stupid special foods he was supposed to like. How that started, God knows. He never turned up.
Harrison probably got the wrong night,
said Mrs. Membury, with a fresh gust of laughter.
Harrison's frightful about time, aren't you, darling? He was never trained for intelligence, you know. He was a librarian in Nairobi. A jolly good one, too. Then he met someone on the ship and got roped in.
And out, said Membury, cheerfully. Kaufman came along. He was the driver. Charming chap. Well, he knew the meeting place like the back of his hand.
I didn't get the wrong night, darling. I got the right one, I know I did. Sat in an empty barn all night. No word from him. Nothing. With no means of getting hold of him. It was all one way. Ate a bit of his stupid food, drank some of his booze. I enjoyed that. Went home. Same again the next night, and the next. I waited for a message of some sort. Phone call, like the first time. Absolute blank. Chap was never heard of again. We should have had a formal handover, with Pym present, of course, but Greensleeves wouldn't allow it. Prima donna, you see, like all agents. One chap at a time. Iron rule. Membury absently helped himself from Brotherhood's glass. Vienna was furious. Blamed it all on me. Then I told them he was no good anyway, and that didn't help. He gave another rich laugh. I should think it got me sacked, if truth were known. They didn't say so, but I'll bet it jolly well helped. Mrs. Membury had made a tuna fish risotto, because it was Friday, and a trifle with cherries on it, which she refused to let Membury eat. When lunch was over, she and Brotherhood stood on the river bank, watching Membury hacking cheerfully at the reeds. Nets and fine wires were stretched all ways across the water. Among the breeding boxes, an old punt was sinking at its moorings. The sun, freed of the mist, beat brightly. So, tell us about the wicked Sabina, Brotherhood suggested artfully, out of Membury's earshot. Mrs. Membury couldn't wait. An absolute minx, she repeated. One look at Magnus and she saw herself with a British passport, a jolly good British husband, and nothing to worry about for the rest of her life. But Magnus was a bit too sly for her, I'm pleased to say. He must have stood her up. He never said so, but that was the way we read it. In Graz, one day, gone the next. Where did she go then? Brotherhood said. Home to Czechoslovakia, that was her story. With her tail between her legs was our theory. Left a note for Harrison saying she was homesick and she was going back to her old boyfriend, despite the beastly regime. Well, that didn't please London, as you can imagine. It didn't raise Harrison's stock one bit. They say he should have seen it coming and done something about it. I wonder what became of her, Brotherhood mused, with an historian's dreaminess. You don't remember her other name, do you?
Harrison! What was Sabina's other name?
With surprising swiftness, the answer rang back across the water.
Court. K-O-R-D-T. Sabina Court. Very beautiful girl. Charming. Marlowe says, what became of her?
God knows. Last we heard, she'd changed her name and landed herself a job in one of the Czech ministries. One of the defectors said she'd been working for him all along.
Mrs. Membury was not so much astonished as proved right. Now, there you are. Married, getting on for 50 years, 30-something years since Austria, and he doesn't even tell me she's turned up in Czechoslovakia, working for one of the ministries. I expect Harrison had an affair with her himself, if truth were known. Practically everybody did. Well, my dear, she must have been a spy, mustn't she? Sticks out a mile. They'd never have taken her back if they hadn't had their hooks on her all along. They're far too vindictive. So Magnus was well rid of her then, wasn't he? Are you sure you won't stay for tea?
If I could take a few of those old photographs, Brotherhood said, we'll give you a credit in the book, naturally.
Mary knew the technique exactly. In Berlin, she had watched Jack Brotherhood use it a dozen times and helped him often. At training camp, they had called it paper chasing. How to make an encounter with someone you don't trust. The only difference was, today it was Mary who was the subject of the operation, and the anonymous writer of the note who didn't trust her. I have information that could lead us both to Magnus. You will please do the following. Any morning between 10 and 12, you will sit in the lobby of the Hotel Ambassador. Any afternoon between 2 and 6, you will take a coffee at the Café Mozart. Any evening between 9 and midnight, the lounge of the Hotel Zacher. Mr. Koenig will collect you. The Mozart was half empty. Mary sat at a centre table where she could be seen.
and ordered herself a coffee and a brandy. They've watched me arrive, and now they're watching to see whether I'm being followed. Pretending to consult her diary, she took covert note of the people round her, and the parked charabangs and fiacres in the square outside the big windows, looking for anything that could resemble a stakeout. When you've got a conscience like mine, everything stinks anyway, she thought. From the two nuns frowning at the stock exchange prices in the window of the bank, to the huddle of bowler-hatted young coachmen stamping their feet and watching the girls go by. In a corner of the cafe, a fat Viennese gentleman was expressing interest in her. I should have worn a hat, she thought. I'm not a respectable single woman. She got up, went to the newspaper rack, and without thinking chose Die Presse. Now I suppose I roll it up and take it for a walk in my stockinged feet, she thought stupidly, as she opened it at the film page. Frau Pimm. A woman's voice, a woman's bosom, a woman's deferentially smiling face. It was the girl from the cash desk. That's right, said Mary, smiling in return. From behind her back she produced an envelope with Frau Pimm written on it in pencil. Herr König left this message for you. He is very sorry. Mary gave her 50 shillings and opened the envelope. Please pay your bill and leave the cafe at once, turning right into the Maisedergasse and remaining on the right-hand pavement. When you reach the pedestrian precinct, turn left and keep to the left side, walking slowly and admiring the shop windows. She wanted the loo, but she didn't like to go in case he thought she was tipping someone off. She put the note in her handbag, finished her coffee, and took her bill to the cash desk, where the girl gave her another smile. These men are all the same, the girl said, while the change rattled down the chute. You're telling me, said Mary. They both laughed. As she left the cafe, a young couple entered, and she had a feeling they were disguised Americans, but then a lot of Austrians were. She turned right, and came at once to the Maisedergasse. The two nuns were still at their stock prices. She kept to the right-hand pavement. It was 3:20, and the wives' meeting was sure to end by 5, so that they could all get home to change into halter dresses and sequin handbags for the evening cattle market. But even when everyone had gone, and only Mary's car remained in the Lumsdens' drive, Fergus and Georgie might well assume she had stayed on for a quiet drink with Caroline on her own. If I make it back by 5:45, I stand a chance, she reckoned. She paused before a woman's lingerie shop and found herself admiring a pair of Tarte's black cami knickers in the window. Who buys that stuff anyway? B. Lederer, £1 to a penny. She hoped something would happen soon, before the ambassadress came out with an armful of the stuff, or one of the many unattached men tried to pick her up. Frau Pimm, I am from Herr König. Please come quickly. The girl was pretty and badly dressed and nervous. Following her, Mary had an overwhelming memory of being back in Prague, visiting a painter the authorities did not approve of. The side street was 1 minute packed with shoppers, the next empty. All Mary's senses were alight. She smelt delicatessen, frost, and tobacco. She glanced into a shop doorway and recognized the man from the Café Mozart. The girl turned left, then right, then left again. Where am I? They entered a paved square. We're in Kärntnerstrasse. We're not. A hippie boy took Mary's photograph and tried to press a card on her. She brushed him aside. A red plastic bear was holding his mouth open for contributions to some charity. An Asian pop group was singing Beatles music. Across the square lay a dual carriageway, and at the near side of it a brown Peugeot waited with a man at the wheel. As they approached, he pushed the back door open at them. The girl grabbed the door and said, "Get in, please." Mary got in, and the girl followed. Must be the ring, she thought. If so, it was not a part of the ring she recognized. She saw a black Mercedes dawdling behind them. Fergus and Georgie, she thought, knowing that it wasn't. Her driver glanced both ways, then pointed the car straight at the central reservation. Bump, it's the front tires, bump, that was my backside you just broke. Everything hooted, and the girl peered anxiously through the back window. They left the carriageway and shot down a side street, across a square, and as far as the opera, where they stopped.